was wrong with them. Somebody asked me about our papers.
You know, I don't like to be real specific about life, right? Because, you know, I don't like to put special dates and say you have to do this by this and that time. I just assume that everybody being responsible people, that they'll get their work done. And that's how we run our companies. You know, like I hire a guy, and if he's got the spirit, then I'll know he'll do the right thing. That's the way I've been trying to treat you people, but some of the students stop me and they say, hey, when do we got to get those papers in? What's the deadline? You know?
Well, maybe we should set a
time, so at least I just need to know that I have enough time to take a look at them and spend the proper time taking a look at them and grading them. But is there any particular date by which I have to have a grade in for the year? I just have to have it sometime before
it should be around the 15th or something.
15th of May?
The final date. So I think it's around the 15th we have the
grades. Okay. So when should we have your papers finished?
Next week.
I assume that some of you would have it done already. You know, like, I mean, you know, don't sleep for 2 or 3 days and that sort of thing, you know, at the last minute, get it all done so that we're not through. You know? So when's a good date? I like to run it democratically.
Oh, but 5 days.
5 days before you leave. Well, maybe, when is our last class? I forget.
April 27th.
April 27th? Is that our last class? Oh, good. Well, hell, I thought it was sometime in May. That gives me
27.
Oh, 27. Well, freedom.
Well, April 20th. Or a deadline.
April 20th?
No, we get April 27th.
Okay, if I don't have to have the grade in till May something, that's fine with me. Okay. Now, is that when we're having our final exam too? Well,
hell. No. We decided to have our papers represent the final exam when you were gone.
Well, I want to be democratic.
We could have our final on the 27th. That way it would be easier for us for our other classes, since we have the following week.
Well, would that be good? I mean, I'm willing to do whatever's fair. Well, I don't know what I'm getting into, but I don't have any problem with, all I need to know is that I've got adequate time to look at them, and you have adequate time to get them done. Some of you would rather not do it, but you're going to have to, right?
How many class meetings do we have between now and then?
Well, I didn't bring my calendar.
We'd only have about 2 class meetings then before the final.
Well, yeah, well, that's not enough. We better just have the papers in. That's not our last class, is it?
Well, that
could be the 4th of May. No, final start.
I know, but I assume that I was just thinking that we had until like mid-May or something. Isn't that, that's not true?
Final start on the 4th of May.
4th of May, but when do they end?
They're over by the 8th.
They are over by the 8th?
The 10th.
None of you are graduating, though. Right? So, finals start on May 8th, huh?
May 4th.
Jeez. 4th to the 8th. Uh-huh. See, a week after this, it's May 1, right? No,
it's May 4th.
May 4th. May 4th. Okay. When do we have to have the grades in, Gary, no?
Well, I can mail them.
Oh, they mail them, so it's not important. You don't need to know whether or not.
If you get an A in the course, you'll get it while you're home and you'll celebrate there, not here. Okay. Well, maybe we'll just plan on having a final, you know, when we're supposed to, huh? Is that on a Monday? Okay. You want to have your paper done on that day too, so you'll have an extra week?
Sure.
Huh? Okay, well, let's just do it that way. Okay, get that piece of business out of the way. Yeah.
If we're not exactly in a group yet, is it okay if we write two individual topic papers?
Are you anti-social or something? No. See, part of the idea was to, I thought you'd cross-fertilize each other. You know, your brain, I mean. I mean, that's part of the idea of doing a group paper.
Is there anybody here that needs one person in their group to go in one specific area?
Come on, somebody be nice to this guy. He might, in fact, help you.
Okay, I'll assume that you'll find some group to connect with. Gosh, it's been about 3 weeks since I've seen you, huh? At least. Did Perry teach you anything the last time?
Mm-hmm. Really good.
Was he good? Was there any substance, though? No. Perry's nice.
Since I've seen you last, I'm in more decrepit shape than ever. You know, aches and pains and all. But discussing what several classes back, you know, I tried to show you the interconnection of everything and what the nub of the problem is and how it affects not only our dealings with the corporation but other institutions. Well, we are continuing our planning in the NANA region, trying to deal with the more important problems. I mean, so what we did was we took a retreat of our board is 23 people, but we met up there by Ivik, which is about 30 miles from Kotzebue, at my sister's cabin. And so what we did was we concentrated not on the business of NANA, but on the condition of our people. And what we have done is we've gotten the elders to agree to sort of begin to reestablish their power, you know, and their function as people who are responsible for the continuity of our people. And so we're doing that by spreading their responsibility not only from the standpoint of advising NANA, you know, on policy issues, but it also gives people, our own shareholders, who may have some criticism of our certain policies that we may have, and if they don't like the way our board disposes of it, then they have an appeal. Right? I mean, if they have something of real substance involving, say, the way we manage our land or anything else, they have an appeal. And the elders have agreed to take on that function, as well as to take a more active role in the educational system. And that was the subject that I was trying to get at with the NEA, you know, the teachers union. One of the real problems we have in dealing with the political system, the educational system, is this idea of credentials that prevent our elders, our parents and grandparents, from being able to spend time in the educational system conveying what we need most, right? That is the sense of identity, the continuity of the language, the traditions, the history, the art, the dance. Well, you know, they've effectively blocked out our people because of these credentials, right? They think we ought to hire some dingling from Chicago, you know? And so we're trying to arrange it so that we can have those youngsters spend as much time adjacent to our elders as possible to carry on that continuity. And so last night And instead of waiting for our board, school board, to take up the subject, which they have not addressed in all these years, you know, my own friends and relatives, we've taken that as a function of the NANA board to deal with. Because people are looking to us, even though we're supposed to be involved in business, they look to us, to the board, as leaders in the region. And so what we've done is we've set up a group who's going to be responsible for meeting with the school board here on the 22nd. And the primary purpose of that meeting is to expand that circle of people who perceive the problem, and hopefully we'll be able to help come up with ideas on how to deal, you know, with the education of our children and the continuity of our people, in addition, of course, to the Western education. So, and last night we met with the school superintendent, who is taking a lot of heat all the time, right? Because it's a sensitive post, and there's all kinds of criticisms, some of which I have made about the educational system in general, but he's feeling the heat because I'm from Kotzebue and they think I'm talking about our region, and so he's, you know, feeling a little funny about it. And likewise, our board, school board, has been saying, well, I've gotten that, really, why didn't he come to talk to us first, you know, instead of blasting off, you know, and making us look bad. Well, I'm trying to tell them that I'm not singling them out, you know, in my perception of how bad the system is, where all we're doing is helping to disintegrate the children further and not really preparing them for life, right, in either society. So, but George White, who's our superintendent, I'm not making a judgment on him now, because, you know, if we haven't given him the direction that he needs, that we think that our, you know, the way we think our children ought to be taught, and he's been sort of floundering around trying to do the best he could without direction, I don't blame him for the situation now. But if we do say, George, you know, we want, say, 50% or what we talked about, 50% of the time and the money of every day, okay, for us, you know, 150% for the Inupiat, you know, and of the time, and maybe even of the personnel, and then he doesn't deliver or doesn't help us get there, then we would have a problem with him. But all these years it's been functioning. If he hasn't performed, or if he's tried to do the best he could, you know, we can't really rightly blame him if our own board has been unable to get down to brass tacks and see, you know, the disintegration that our school system helps do to our children, you know. Anyway, that's sort of a running account about what's happening, at least in our region. And the reality of it is that we have to be together. I mean, our board, there has to be absolutely no argument about what our basic goals are, you know, and we'll talk it out till we have agreement, and that's normally the way we do it. And what George says is that there's a lot that can be done. You know, and it's going to take a lot of work, and maybe even changing of some laws to and regulations to accomplish what we need to do to survive. But I think we're willing to take them on as, you know, as we recognize what those are.
How hard was it to convince the air elders to play that role? You know?
Well, I thought I described to you. When I went up to that elders conference that we had in our region a few weeks ago, and we had the chairman of our board and the president present the problem. You know, because what we did was, you know, about 15 years ago, because our elders had, you know, for one reason or another, they had not been able to grasp or see the problem, that is, we had to move. So some of us young guys just went in and we just grabbed it, right? And tried to get a hold of it. And quite some years, our elders had sort of allowed the missionaries and the government and the bureaucrats and the traders sort of to, well, to begin to listen to them, or at least not to, not fight. And presumably they felt it was better for their children, maybe it's going to be easier for their children to survive if they let them go. See, so it hasn't been easy. You know, we've gone from, we're trying to go from one extreme to the other in the way they perceive the way life is supposed to be. You know, on one hand, the government would say, you got to get rid of the language. They beat you on the hands if you spoke it. You know, you had to completely change your way. The missionary said you had to eliminate your dance, you know, because it was evil, because it was sinful. And then here we come along and say, you know, Christ, you know, we need some help. We got to survive. You know? And so they're like, well, what's going on? They, so there's some confusion there. and so the elders, they talked about it for several days. And they in fact, they are moving in some places faster than others, but they're setting up their elders' groups in each community. Right? And out of that group, we'll have another group that sort of advises Nana, and they'll also be involved in leadership selection. So it's not that easy, because a good many of our elders also, their minds have been taken as well. Their minds have been taken by the church in many instances, to the point where it's been self-destructive to the continuity of our people. So what we've had to try to do is show that that we're not trying to get into the religious, spiritual realm. Right? We're trying to show that we're getting into the Inupiaq spirit realm. And anything beyond that is individual and sort of like religion type. But, or that sometimes we say that what we're talking about is the Inupiaq spirit, which is a Christian spirit. So, anyway, I just wanted to kind of bring you sort of up to date on that effort, because it's kind of a revolutionary kind of thought, because it goes against the grain of, you know, a century of sort of government and initially colonial type policy and government policy and a meeting of direction between the church and government and politics. So all we're trying to say is that we have a right to be who we are, which doesn't mean that we don't get involved in the system. But I'm wasting valuable time. What I want to do is introduce our speaker for today. And I was very happy that Don Wright agreed to come and speak. I was sitting in my office late one night a few weeks ago in Anchorage, and I called Don out of the blue and asked him if he'd be interested in the appeal. So, some of you have read about Don, you know, in this or that book dealing with the claims. And when I called Don on Saturday, I asked him maybe to concentrate on four or five areas, but I said maybe he might want to talk about his role, you know, in the Settlement Act process itself. He might want to talk about the corporate concept and his first recognition of that as a vehicle and how he felt it has worked. I asked him to kind of talk about the various political leaders that that were involved in the settlement. I'm not sure what elements of those you all wanted to cover, but I was sort of leaving it up to Don to speak on whatever he thought was important, because I don't think we've used people like Don enough who've been there, you know, to convey some sense of his perception of the settlement itself. And Don carried a great deal of the responsibility for negotiating with the Congress properties. And Don has a lot to say, but I was wondering whether or not there was something in particular that we could lay out here that you would be particularly interested in. I mean, don't be lengthy, just tell me a something.
Something about the all last one we did about him and David, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. About the land thing. What was it? The royalty? The subject about if you make so much money, profit, you know, that it should be given to.
Oh, I see. Is that that 7J thing?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can talk about it. Okay, let's put it this way. Let's put about, we could talk about the politics of the act, certain elements of it, whether you want to talk about the native aspect of it or the relationship with the state back then, or there's any number of elements, right? You could talk about the conservationist role, you could talk about labor, talk about the feds, I guess. You could talk about any number of things, or you could talk about the contents of the act, right? Which could be you could talk about the land, or you might want to talk about the vehicle of the settlement, the corporations, or you might want to talk about 7J or 7I, which are a couple of major sort of unresolved aspects of it. Just might want to talk about the Federation. Maybe talk about any number of things. So I'll just leave it with you, Don, and unless there's something else that some other aspect that we want to.
Well, aren't you still an agent for Unified Indian Reservation?
I work in the council.
They recently went from, they turned over all of their land over to the village council.
Yeah,
I read this.
Yeah.
Were you in the first Town and Out Chiefs meeting? When was that?
I was not in the 62 meeting. I first got really actively involved in 66. I moved to Fairbanks Bank Street in 66.
You were the man in that time, weren't you, Jeff?
I had attended a lot of the meetings prior to that. Jewel, my brother, was one of the leaders up here then. I moved to Anchorage and became a leader within that.
Well, anything else?
Maybe
some systems. Boy, I sure don't like that word. It's almost like the word native.
That's the word, like.
Yeah. This is a politics class, so you can talk just about anything, any subject matter that you are interested in. Okay, I feel like I'm using up valuable time, so before we go any further, I'd like to introduce Don's wife, Judy, back in the back there. So, it's all yours, Don.
Thank you, Willie. I'll just give you a little brief overview of how I got involved and where I got involved, and then feel absolutely free to ask on any subject any questions you might have relative to the Act, the formation of the Act, the implementation of the Act, how it evolved from a state level, how it evolved from a federal level, how it evolved from the village level, and so forth. I was born in Nenana. My father was a half-breed Athabascan Indian. He worked very closely with the Episcopal Church. My mother came into the country in 1918 as a missionary nurse to Ninana. My father and mother worked closely with early Episcopal missionaries, Archdeacon Stuck and Bishop Rowe and some of those fellows, and traveled the rivers extensively in the summertime by boat, and traveled Yukon Territory and most of Alaska in the wintertime with dog teams. My father was a very expert interpreter, spoke the language fluently. I learned a lot through him because at that time Ninana was very small, and we lived 3 years in Minto, and that was smaller yet. My father established a missionary mission at Allakaket and a mission at Tanana Crossings, and then he ended up getting in a political fight with the church and quit the church. He was an ordained minister, but he quit the church because he couldn't live by their demands on the native people. My mother also quit the church, and my father died in 1947. My mother died just last year. She was 84 years old. My family is seven brothers, no girls. Many of you probably heard of Al Wright Air Service. He flies the country over. He's one of my brothers. Gareth Wright, the dog musher, is another brother. Link Wright, Jules Wright, Gene Wright, and a younger brother got killed up out of Eagle going to the Mackenzie River country with the Alaska Freight Lines when they were trying to build a road for hauling materials and supplies for the Dew Line in the Arctic. I came to Fairbanks to graduate from high school. I spent the last 2 years of high school in Fairbanks and graduated in 1947. I never went to college. I went into construction. I learned to fly. I worked the riverboats. And in 1966, when the Native Land Claims Movement was in its infancy, and Frank Degnan from Unalakleet and some of the guys like Harvey Samuelson from Dillingham and Charlie Franz from Sandpoint and the Shumigan Islands, and Willie was emerging, writing good things from the university, and Emil Noddy was emerging, and some of the others. I moved to Anchorage because I felt that the native position had to be expressed in terms that the politicians and the business community could understand. And there weren't that many native leaders that had business experience and had been exposed in travel and in politics to where I felt that they could articulate their position. My brother Jules was one of the presidents of the Fairbanks Native Association. He was also elected to the legislature. He served with Willie Hensley. I forget what year it was, but it was back there some before land claims. I looked political. I looked at the whole thing politically, and I thought, you know, there was really nothing I could do in the legislature, for example, when there were guys like Jules and Willie in there, because they could do the job in the legislative body as well as anyone. And there was no need to try to get too many of us in there. So I tackled the national scene. I never did run for a state position, and well, I did in 68, but it was by appointment. But I ran for Congress in 68. I moved to Anchorage in 66, became the president of the Cook Inlet Native Association. I was one of the charter members and framers of the Alaska Federation of Native Association, and I ran for Congress. It gave me access to the people who would be making decisions on the national scene. It gave me access to the big money interests and where they were coming from, because anytime you run for an office like that, it's one-on-one. And if you can talk eyeball to eyeball with the wheels that are running, it gives you a quick education and it gives you a great exposure. I was not successful. Since then, I have run for governor and I've run for United States Senate and I've never been successful. I've run on the Democratic Party ticket. I've run on the Independence Party ticket. I've run on the Republican ticket. So I know a little bit about politics. The native land claims actually began prior to the Treaty of Session. The Russians, the Spanish, a lot of the names you see in South Central Alaska, like Valdez and Cordova, those were Spanish sort of settlements. A lot of Russians in the Aleutian area, a lot of Norwegian and Finnish and Swedish in the Cook Inlet region, and a lot of English and French in the interior. Those people came to the country looking for something, many of them before the Treaty of Session, and they dealt honorably with the natives, as Columbus and the Pilgrims did, because they were a minority and they had no choice. Russia actually treated the natives in some parts of Alaska better than the United States ever did. Some places they exploited them and were pretty rough on them. There were national wars in Alaska, minor miniature type wars, the Thlinkets and Haidas, the Athabascans, the Eskimos. There's stories of when my grandfathers and grandmothers fought with Willie's folks out there. St. John's in the wilderness, Allakaket and Alatna are two villages. One is on the Eskimo side of the river and one is on the Indian side of the river. My father established the one on the Indian side of the river. There's a lot of history in books written by Archdeacon Stuck and by different missionaries that established religious settlements in the state that lead into land claims. And my father used to say that there was no way that he would die letting them take the land from the native people. I didn't understand what he was talking about until World War II. And we saw, I was getting old enough then, we saw 500,000 troops move into the territory. We saw them push through the Alcan Highway. We saw thousands of men and women coming through the country on the railroad and going down the river, establishing airfields for ferrying airplanes to Russia. Thousands and thousands of drums of fuel oil and gasoline going down the Yukon, polluting the streams, polluting the lakes. We saw the mining industry move, the United States smelting, mining, and refining here into Esther and up the Chattanooga. And we saw the Minto Flats completely overlaying beautiful swamp lands, the lakes of wild rice and vegetation that the ducks and the muskrats and the beaver and everything could subsist on, completely ruined by the outwash from mining. So we decided that we'd have to try to do something about that. And we formed the Alaska Federation of Natives. When we first organized, we tried to figure out how to do it. And the Tyonic Indians had come into considerable money through lease, bonus leases for oil exploration from what's now Exxon Company, Exxon Corporation. And they offered to fund a statewide convention for organizing the Alaska Natives in a land claims fight. And the first thought was, are we considered civilized or not? The Treaty of Session between the United States and Russia is very clear. It says that the United States shall grant citizenship to all peoples that are in the territory who wish to become American citizens. That's a precedent set
by the treaty, which is the supreme law of the land. Those that chose to pledge allegiance to Russia were free to go back to Russia. And they would deal with all except, quote, the uncivilized tribes of natives, Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut people. Well, it's pretty hard for any of us, or it was pretty hard for any of us, to think that we were not civilized. You know, it's sort of like saying that Columbus was not civilized. He was kind of a barbarian. Or Cortez, or whoever. We never could accept that. So the treaty says that if they're civilized, then they have aboriginal title and they own all of the land. And if the United States or any other nation or any private enterprise wants any of that land, then they either have to purchase it or negotiate for it, or they have to take it by force. And there was no way that anyone was going to consider taking it by force. So that was eliminated. If the government needed it, then there's provisions in the Constitution and in the laws of America that say public necessity clearly requires the taking, then pay just compensation. But the United States government is prohibited by the Constitution from taking more land than is clearly required for public necessity. And obviously, they didn't need the whole state for public necessity. So then the question was, what about the definition of civilized? If we weren't civilized, then does that mean that Congress could just ignore us forever? Does that mean that we have no rights at all? If we're uncivilized, how come we can vote? You know, if we're not citizens, how come we can vote? And we compared Alaska to Texas. Texas came into the Union at the request of a small group of people. Incidentally, it happened to be guys like President Johnson's ancestors. They stole that land. They had a little revolution down there, and they stole it from the Indians, and they declared themselves a sovereign. Texas was a foreign nation. It'd be just as foreign as Japan. It would be just as foreign as Mexico. It'd be just as foreign as Germany or Russia. Texas was a foreign nation. And immediately, those soldiers of fortune, if you please, ran to Washington, D.C., and said, look, there's no way we can defend ourselves against the Indians. There's no way we can defend ourselves against Mexico. We want to become a state. And that foreign nation petitioned the Congress to become a state. And the Congress accepted that petition. And they ramrodded it through, and Texas became the largest state in the nation. Not 1 acre of federal land, not 1 acre of state land. Every single acre of land belonged to private individuals who just took the map and said, Johnsons will take this, and the Kennedys will take this, and the Vanderbilts will take that, and the Rockefellers will take this. No concern for the native, no concern whether it was a Mexican or an Indian or a Chinese or whatever. They took that land, private ownership. Then in their benevolence, they saw fit to give the state of Texas enough land for a capital. And then they created a little park here. They gave it to them, used tax advantages in doing it. They gave a little to the federal government for docks and arsenals, which they would have come for anyway. We looked at that and we thought, how come they could do that in Texas under duress, under the disguise of war? A lot of people, you know, during that revolution, a lot of people lived in Texas didn't even know there was a war. They didn't even know that it was an independent nation, and they didn't even know that it eventually became a state until years afterwards. We thought, how could we, and a lot of our people didn't know that there was a treaty of cession. with Russia, and they didn't know that there was a convention between Great Britain and Russia and the United States, and they didn't know about Cordova and Valdez. I mean, lots of people in Willie's area, the old folks, they knew nothing about anything except what was there in their area. People I work for now, Arctic Village Venati, they didn't know that there was a Canadian government or a border between Alaska. My grandmother, incidentally, comes from Old Crow. Well, I'm sure that she didn't know she was crossing the border, because there was no border. So we got to thinking about that and wondering how we could inform the people and how we could fit into the system and not, you know, cause too much disturbance, because we knew that if we got the hackles up on the big money and interest on the high-powered politicians, that we would lose it all. They might even put us in jail. They might even shoot us. You know, we didn't know. So we thought about it for a long time, and we finally decided that if we had a federation, if we could get the voice of the people out, if we could use the media, newspapers, television, radio, if we could talk to the churches and get their support, because they believed in peace, and if we could talk to the labor unions and explain to them that the development of the resources would benefit their membership, that would include the shipping interests of the longshoremen, the maritime people, that would include the heavy equipment operators, carpenters, everybody, that it would be a good way to go. So we started. Hickel was elected governor, and he had a guy named Burr, an attorney general. We had our first statewide meeting here in Fairbanks at the Travelers Inn. And Mr. Burr was just like Aaron Burr. He was a timid, overbearing, racist, chauvinistic white man. And we saw that he was scared of Indians. So we deliberately scared him. We deliberately intimidated him. And he was so scared that he was afraid to address the convention on behalf of the state of Alaska as an elected official. The attorney general, the big man in the law, is scared to address us. The meeting sort of ended in kind of a hilarious, the Indians all sat down in the bar and got drunk and laughed about it, and he ran back to Anchorage or wherever he came from. I'm over-dramatizing this a little, but it's a true story, and you can check it out. He went back, and then we talked to Hickel and said, if you got that kind of an attorney general, you might as well forget it. You'll never have peace with the Indians. Well, Maury Thompson was his protege, and Maury was sort of the in guy for the natives. And Hickel is a brilliant man. He's a good businessman, and he could see the handwriting on the wall from a business standpoint, from a political standpoint. So it wasn't long until Burr was gone, and a guy named Ed Boyko came on the scene as the attorney general. And in the process, Hickel agreed to set up a, what do we call it, really a task force for rural affairs. And we had to figure out carefully how to name it so that politically it wouldn't be state funds funding it for a special a group of ethnic group, i.e. Indian Esquimalt. So instead of it being a native task force, it was a rural affairs task force. And he agreed to put some money into it, and we intimidated the Interior Department, in a sense. We told them, you know, that there was going to be war if they didn't do something. So they agreed to send a guy or a couple guys from the Interior Department to sit on the task force, and they agreed to let it be controlled by the natives. So we proceeded with this task force. It was made up of a majority of natives, representatives from the state and representatives from the federal government, to try to devise a settlement that might fit and pass Congress. And we struggled with it for weeks, for months, and we just couldn't agree. Interior said, no, we're not going to let go of this land. We need monuments, we need parks, we need this. The state said, no, we're not going to let you have any of our land. We rationalized, look, fellas, I mean, after all, there's 220 little villages. I mean, not counting Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka. There's 220 little villages. There aren't any white people in them. Some of them might have a school teacher or a preacher. Now, how can you say that the state has prior right to that village? Or how can you say the federal government has a right to make a reserve out of it? You put more credence in the brown bears than you do on the people. That's not fair. If you're going to make a reservation for brown bears, why don't you make one for the Indians and the Eskimos? So we went round and round. And it ended at a point where we decided that we had to take the initiative and run with it.
You know, it can pick it up if you talk real loud and adjust it kind of down to a moderate level. This one doesn't do that.
Simply said, we own all the land, and if you, through public necessity, need it, Mr. United States, Mr. State of Alaska, then just authorize us to go to the Court of Claims for compensation for extinguishment of our title. The state thought that was great. They were 100% for it. Our delegation thought that was great. They thought they were all for it, but when it hit the Congress and hit the hopper, Scoop Jackson and Humphrey and Kennedy and a bunch of them guys, you know, went right into orbit. They said, there's no way. It would be an astronomical figure. It would be quadrillions of dollars fair value for the whole thing. We can't consider it. So they wouldn't consider it. So we went back to the drawing board. And so they would come up with ideas. Aspinall or Haley or on the House side or McGovern or Jackson on the Senate side would come up with ideas. And they'd come up with ideas from a million acres total, and maybe $10 million or $100 million total. To at one point, Jackson agreed to 7 or 8 million acres and $100 million. And by then, we're starting to fight amongst ourselves a little bit because the lawyers are moving in. They're making recommendations. Goldberg was formerly a Chief Justice for the Supreme Court. Ramsey Clark was formerly a Attorney General for the United States under the Kennedy administration. Kiko, a firm out of California, was formerly a senator, powerful man. They came in to represent the natives, and they wrote us a contract that said they'd take 10% of the settlement. Well, some of our leadership was agreeing to do it, and so we had a kind of a revolution in amongst ourselves. And the Senate was anxiously trying to pass a bill to get it over with. The House was waiting to see what the Senate was going to do, and we were all sort of disoriented. So we come through another crisis. The Congress time ran out, and the bill died, and it passed the Senate side, I think. I don't think it ever did pass, did it? The Senate side? No, it failed every time. And we finally decided the best way to fight him was to just get a little tougher, so we went redrafted our bill. The first time we went in, it was 40 million acres, $1 billion, and 2% overriding royalty in perpetuity. Secretary Udall came up and suggested outer continental shelf revenues. We said we'd go for that. The minute we said we'd go for that, he went back to Washington. Washington said absolutely not. No, they knew it was too valuable. So we decided we'd raise the ante, and we raised it to 60 million acres, 2% overriding royalty, and $1 billion. We went back and we fought and fought and fought and couldn't get anywhere. People like Aspinall, who was chairman of the full Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, and Haley, who was a subcommittee member, they just wouldn't move it. They just didn't want to settle. Guys like Jackson, and by then Senator Stevens and Gravel, they wanted a settlement. They were working hard for it. Nick Biggs was working hard for it. But we just couldn't get the support. So Nick Biggs and Gravel and Stevens all refused to take our position. They thought it was too much. And, you know, think of this politically. Who are they representing? You know, who are those congressmen and senators representing? They're representing us. Now, if you had a business and you went to him individually and said, I'd like you to put this bill in the hopper for me, he would do it. Any one of them would do it for an individual. They'd do it for an oil company. They'd do it for a milk lobby or something else. But they wouldn't do it for the natives of Alaska. So we had to go back to Congress, and we had to find people in the House and the Senate that were willing to do it. Kennedy came on our side for 40 million acres. Humphrey came on our side. Harris of Oklahoma came on our side. We got all the Indian organizations on our side. We got the churches on our side, and so forth. We ended up with, I think it was 17 committed sponsors on the Senate side and 140 on the House side. And even after we got that many congressmen and senators representing, who were willing to put our bill in, outside of Alaska, Stevens and Gravel and Biggs refused to do it. And we had to bring them on by request of those other senators and House members. Now that's criminal, absolutely criminal. As a matter of fact, that's in violation of their constitutional oath when they were elected. We didn't want to get into that. Anyway, we got the bill in. Meantime, the other members scurried for lesser bills, trying to get them to be more popular. And even the Secretary of the Interior, Roger C.B. Morton, introduced a bill allegedly on behalf of the administration for some amount, I forget what it was, 10 million acres or something like that. We had to figure out another way. So I took, on a 4th of July, I took the paperwork that we had, all of our propaganda. I walked through the Smithsonian Institute. I listened to the audio Declaration of Independence being read, and all those other great things. I walked to the Russian embassy, and I rattled the gate. The guy came out there, and I said, I want to talk to Mr. DeBrina. He said, who are you? And some more guys came, and they took me in. I explained what I wanted. I told them that the United States was violating a treaty between them and Russia, that they were not treating us as they had treated other Aboriginal peoples. And I wanted the Russian interpretation of that treaty accession. I wanted one question answered. Did Russia consider us civilized or uncivilized? They sent me away and told me that I'd hear from them. A while later, they sent a guy over and told me that they would talk to me. So we went over and spent a whole day with him. I showed him the whole thing, laid it all out to him, just as I had done to congressmen and senators and others. And they said that they couldn't make that decision. They couldn't give me that answer. They were totally sympathetic, that they thought it was terrible the United States was treating us like this, but that they couldn't do anything about it. That got the attention of some of the people in the White House. Vice President Agnew's daughter, Kim, I believe her name was kind of having a little growing up problem. And Wendell Chino, the chairman of the Mescalero Apaches, made arrangements for her to spend part of her vacation, summer vacation, on the Mescalero Apache Reservation. So, with some help from Bob Jim of the Yakima and Joe Dan Osceola from the Seminoles and Bruce Wilkie of the Macaws, Earl Oldperson of the Blackfeet, I got a mole in the Mescalero Reservation to find out, you know, how Kim felt about it and how she was relating to the Indians, et cetera, et cetera. And she loved the Indians. She thought they were mistreated, and she understood everything. And through a friend of hers, we worked our way to Vice President Agnew. And Al Ketzler...
You didn't have to pay, did you?
No. Al Ketzler and Senator Ray Christensen and Laura Burke and I forget who all went. We had a private meeting with Agnew, but I got to tell you, this is a humorous part of it. Charlie Edwardson, Etuck, many of you, all of you probably know him. He was very influential in everything that was going on. He was the president or the chairman of the North Slope Regional Organization. He was very boisterous about everything he did. The tribes of the United States, all the tribes, the National Tribal Chairman Association, National Congress of American Indians, were holding a joint conference in Kansas City. And we decided, and Agnew was going to address them. And we decided it'd be a good time to go to Kansas City and try to get an audience with the vice president. And he agreed to an audience through the White House. So we get all set up for the meeting, and they set us up a nice table with Secret Service men and all. We're all patiently sitting there ready to talk to the vice president. And for security reasons, they would only let certain people in. You had to get security clearance. And Charlie couldn't get clearance, and he got mad. So just as the vice president was coming in from one side, Charlie boomed in from the other side. Said, there ain't going to be no goddamn meeting with the vice president of the United States if I ain't in here. And he got all upset, and he banged on the table and smashed it to the floor, and the Secret Service men flew, and Agnew went out and got on his airplane and went back to Washington. So we got on the airplane right behind, another airplane right behind him, and chased him back to Washington, tried to smooth things over. They said that they'd let us have a meeting with the vice president in a day or two if we would keep everybody else out. So finally we did, and that's when we had it with Al Ketzler and Senator Christensen and Laura Hagberg, or Laura Burke. And he gave us all the time we wanted. I forget how many hours we were with him, but he was very sympathetic. He looked at our position. He said, as far as he's concerned, our position was reasonable, and that he would convey that to the president. And we asked him to try to set a meeting up with the president if he could. He immediately went from that meeting and assigned a guy named Brad Patterson, who is now with the Brookings Institute, to be the individual representing the White House to negotiate administration position on this. We went back to Anchorage. I got a call from Ehrlichman. He said they would meet with us if I'd come. I got on the plane, I flew back. I met for 18 hours with Brad Patterson in the White House. Laid out the position of the Federation. He had some problems with it. He said he'd give me a list of them and I could take them back to the Federation. We went back and forth like that for weeks. Finally came out with a bill that the administration said they could support for 40 million acres and $962.5 million. We wanted 2% overriding royalty. We wanted all subsistence rights, hunting rights, privileges, all that. We wanted to have three choices: traditional village recognition under IRA, or just traditional, like a treaty. Regional, village, and a statewide corporation. And the other choice would be village and region, and just those reservations in the state existing have a right to retain their reservation status. You have to go back a little and recognize that Ted Stevens, Senator Stevens, came to this country as a solicitor for the Department of the Interior under the Eisenhower administration. The Eisenhower administration was total terminationist. They were totally against any kind of native rights. And they tried to terminate the tribes throughout the United States. It didn't work. It backfired on them. So basically,
Ted's training was terminationist. Henry Jackson is a terminationist. Aspinall is a terminationist. So all the main players in this were terminationists.
Now, John, I don't know. I guess you understand what that means, right? You might want to describe that term.
Termination. Well, they feel that the Indians should have no special rights of identity. They should have no land right. They shouldn't be able to practice their own religion. They shouldn't be able to live a subsistence lifestyle. They shouldn't be able to live traditionally. They should be educated and, quote, integrated into the mainstream of society in America. And that's what they have endeavored to do the past 100 years. That's been the Bureau of Policy for 100 years.
They didn't want there to be separate governments, right?
That's correct. Yeah. They wanted it to, they wanted the natives to become members of the cities, members of the boroughs, members of the state. They didn't want them to have their own form of government. When the administration pulled the bill that was introduced by Secretary Morton and reintroduced this other one, needless to say, it made headlines, and all the big people in the political world were absolutely shocked. They couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that the President of the United States would do that. And incidentally, that's the first time in the history of the United States that Indian leaders ever negotiated with the President of the United States personally. First time in history, I mean in all of American history. And it was a shocker to a lot of people. They didn't know quite how to handle that or what to do about it. And they didn't know how really determined the President of the United States and his cabinet were to see this thing move. I think that they imagined that he was more determined than he really was, which was in favor of the natives under the circumstance. But in any event, from there it went to the fight for the passage. They passed the bill on the Senate side, they passed the bill on the House side. They were so far apart they put it in free conference. When they're in free conference, they would not allow us to participate, which is terribly undemocratic. They did it behind closed doors. We could send a runner in that they would approve of, and he could make some changes. We could give some of our stuff to some of our delegates, like Stevens or Gravel or Begich. Others would give, you know, from other lobby would give them things also. Finally, we got Gravel, Stevens, Governor Egan, John Havelock, the Attorney General, and Nick Begich to agree to a position to take before the conference committee as our kind of bottom line. We didn't win on that either. They wouldn't, number one, agree to a 2% overriding royalty under any circumstance. They wouldn't agree to the Indians having their own form of government in their own communities. There were a lot of things they wouldn't agree to. Net result, anyway, is as you read in ANCSA, and there's lots and lots of stories of how it came to pass and where the players were and what we had to do to. I'll tell you another funny one. I got drunk in a bar at Capitol Hill Hotel because things weren't going too good, and I was sitting there, and this Chinese guy came up to me. He said, "What's the matter, Don?" I said, "How do you know me?" He says, "Oh, everybody knows you around here." I said, "Well, who are you?" And we shook hands. He said, "I know what you're trying to do." He said, "You're trying to get that land for all them Indians and Eskimos in Alaska." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Well, I work for the Chinese government." He said, "I work for Madam Chang. She got Flying Tiger Line." He said, "I'm a lobbyist." He said, "I know all about it." He said, "You want me to help you?" And I said, "Sure." I call it my Chinese connection. He says, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, Congressman Haley has this bill locked up in subcommittee and he won't let it out. They won't consider it. It's just sitting there. Been there for a couple of months." "Oh, Congressman Haley," he said, "that's no trouble." He said, "I'll tell you how to do that." I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "You got to get in his back pocket." I said, "How do you get in his back pocket?" He says, "You got to make him spend money." I said, "How do you make him spend money?" He said, "You got to make a deal to where you go to his hometown, which is Sarasota, Florida. Incidentally, happened to be where Ralph Rivers was retired. It also happened to be the seat of the United Southeast Tribes headquarters. And the executive director happened to be Bruce Wilkie, one of my friends from Macau. So we jimmied up this big press conference. We had USET and Congressman Rivers and them call all the news media, all the television, radio stations, everything, that this leader, Wright, was coming down there and make some statements and do some things and make a presentation. And they wanted the people of Sarasota, the fine people of Sarasota, to write their congressman. It was very simple, but very necessary, et cetera, et cetera. So we took Francis Stegman and Brenda Itta and a bunch of the good-looking Eskimo girls, Indian girls, and a bunch of us, and we flew to Sarasota. We had this press conference at the airport, and they said, well, what can we do? What can the people do? We said, all we want them to do is write letters to Congressman Haley, tell him to move the Alaska Native Land Claims Bill out of his committee. He got so damn many letters that he has to hire staff to answer them, and then it takes from his budget to answer them. He called me up on the telephone, and he says, right, call off your dogs. I'll move the goddamn bill. So that's real politics. Anyway, the thing emerged such as it is. Corporate concept originated with the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives' key members like Jackson and Aspinall. They knew and they know that one way of terminating Indians, Eskimos, from their money and their land is to force them to form corporate entities where they don't really understand it, and without proper management and leadership, eventually they're going to be stripped of their wealth. We knew that we couldn't pass it without that concept. So it was fruitless to try to fight on our terms when we were broke, and we had nothing to work with, and we needed something to work with. So a lot of us felt that if we could get it passed, get some land and money, this would maybe only be the beginning of the fight. If the Constitution of the United States is real, if the Congress is real, if America is real, then we'll get a second chance at it. So the corporate concept sort of evolved from there, and we tried to figure out how best to make it work. Our basic philosophy was that we should have a statewide organization that would have 5%. And that would be the mother organization that could furnish expertise, legal, technical, accounting, et cetera, to the villages. We, in our final draft, felt that 7 to 12 regions would be sufficient, and they would be sort of like sub-region from the AFN. But they would receive maybe 20 or 15 or 20% of the money, and maybe 75 or 80% of the money would be distributed amongst all of the villages, and they could form as regional or nonprofit corporations, I mean village for-profit or nonprofit corporations. And that if the villages or the individuals who were growing at large wanted to invest like ordinary citizens with money, they could reinvest either in their village corporation or in their regional corporation, or they could start something else or do what they wanted to. But we felt that a majority of the money should go back to the people to raise the standard of living in the villages. The thing we feared was that there would be a great exodus if they went corporate. They'd all move into Fairbanks or Anchorage or Juneau, and the villages would be abandoned. We feared that. That's still a fear, particularly if the villages don't have a guaranteed infusion on an annual basis of capital. That's what the 7J fight is all about. I've talked enough. Ask specific questions and I'll give you specific answers. I brought some material with me in case you want to see it for reference, quite a bit. And incidentally, I have copies of all of the minutes of the AFN from its beginning until I was ousted. And even have some from after I was ousted. I have videotapes of all of the meetings that We could possibly videotape. Couldn't do it in Washington, but as we were building the land claims package, days of meetings in places like Bethel and Point Barrow and Juneau and Fairbanks and Anchorage and wherever. And I have 8 hours of tapes, the final convention, when we were reviewing the final act for just prior, after it passed both houses, just prior to the president's signature, including the president's, when he called us and on a tape message told us that he signed the act. So any of that kind of stuff is available anytime any class like this needs it or wants it. Or
this may be kind of a slightly off question, but in the 40 million acre figure, when that's totally decided on and the land is all, you know, absolutely determined and everything, will the ownership be the same type of ownership if I went down and bought a house lot for $1,000? Is it going to be that type of ownership in,
yes,
in the final conclusion? So they have
fee title. And it'll vest in the region. Pardon? The Congress wouldn't go for a statewide organization. They were afraid of a powerful political structure. So, yeah, the state was mostly against it, but the Congress was against it too. They felt that if the whole Native community stuck together and were financed, that they would be not only dangerous politically in the state to special interests, but they would be dangerous to major investment companies because of their size.
Could you elect it? Could there are 7 regions or 13 regions elected to give you that 5% of that salary?
Oh yeah, they could still do that. But it's once money, you know, it's sort of like a family, and you got 10 kids and you got $100 and you give them each $10 and then say, now, would you kids rather have a bicycle and share it, or would you rather go buy candy with $10? They'll never put it back together. They could, don't misunderstand, but the type of leadership that we have in the regions, the villages today, they compete with each other, they won't cooperate. But that's human nature.
Can you explain the difference between, like, the claim Zach gave us fee title land, and other, like, reservations have Indian titles, Indian land, and this is actually fee title?
No, the reservations are fee title also.
In Alaska? Or?
Yeah. The way a reservation, under the Indian Reorganization Act, the secretary has the authority to set aside certain lands in trust for the specific use and benefit of certain Indian or Eskimo people. They set aside 9 of them, like, well, plus Metlakatla, but they set aside Venati and Tetlin and St. Lawrence Island and Elam and like that. When the land claims passed, they extinguished the title. And they put the property back in what they call public domain. Then under the charge of the Bureau of Land Management, they reissued a patent for that land that was contained within that reserve and for each of the regional village selections. The regions end up with all of the subsurface outside of those reservation areas, and the villages end up with about half, about 22 million acres of surface title only.
Why did the Venati Reservation choose to go from a proper status to IRA controlling the land?
The Land Claim Settlement Act did not extinguish the governmental authority of the IRA. See, under the Wheeler-Howard Act, the Indian Reorganization Act, tribes were entitled to form as government entities under Section 16 and as federally chartered corporations under Section 17. The ANCSA Act did not extinguish those governments or corporations. All they did was take the land away. What Venati did is they received patent of the land in the two state chartered corporations, and those two state chartered corporations conveyed the land to the IRA. So the land is now in trust to the IRA, not the federal government. And they function as a corporate entity under Section 17 as the Native Village of Unitai federally chartered corporation. The other regions could do the same thing if they wanted to.
What are the advantages of
that? Tremendous advantage. The advantage is that you're not subject to the state or local taxes. In other words, the natives, being the biggest quote, private landholders in the state, are subject to the whims of the legislature. And where do those guys come from? They come from all over the world. We've got, you know, Japanese and Filipino and Chinese. They're all, pretty soon they'll all be in the legislature, citizens. And they'll take that away. Under the IRA, they have their own government. They can tax, and they're immune from taxation.
Even regional corporations could.
They could if they wanted to. But I haven't seen any of them headed that direction yet. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true.
Not very.
No, you take, in Southeast, there's one village that I just read the other day. They sold off 20% of their timber, and it's enough money to guarantee $25,000 a year to each stockholder for the next 10 or 15 years. Nana is doing lots of exploration on mineral and oil, gas, things like that. Doyon is. Doyon's got several big mining potentials in asbestos, in gold, things like that. So, yeah, they're working on developing, but it takes a long time to explore, figure out the best use, and then develop it.
Okay, let me rephrase that. To give the land to the people. I mean, never done anything to get it to the people. I mean, this land was conveyed or whatever.
No, it isn't, to my knowledge, but they have that right if they want to.
The corporation or the people?
Well, the people are the corporation. See, there's where the fallacy is. The people are stockholders in the corporation. They have an annual meeting, they elect their directors. If the people say, we want 1,000 acres apiece for farming, the board of directors has the authority to give it to them. But you're not finding any of them doing that. Yeah. But that's not, that it's still possible. It's just not being done. I don't think the people understand the power they have. The same problem is this 7I and 7J. The villages are fighting the corporations, the regional corporations, the village corporation fighting the regional corporation. It's senseless. Now, you see the village of Barrow, they hire their lawyers and their experts. The region of Barrow, of Arctic Slope, they hire their lawyers and their experts, and they're fighting in court over whether the villages should get the money that they're entitled to by the Act. And the courts won't let them do anything with it until it's settled in court. So what's it going to mean? It's going to mean that no matter who wins in a lower court, like under Judge Vonderheide, the other side will appeal it to the Ninth Circuit. That might take a year or two. And then whoever wins there appeals to the United States Supreme Court. That could take 10 years. So the people are getting no benefit or use out of it while they're fighting about it. When all they'd have to do, for an example, the village of Barrow is a majority of the village of the region. The same people, identical people in the village are a majority of the people in the region. And here they are fighting because they don't understand.
John, what about if they have a net loss like the region did? Do they get a share of their share of that?
they have already lost it because that's one corporate entity. That's why big corporations diversify. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. And if a corporation is losing money, maybe you ought to cut her down and find out why. And if it's losing too much, like the Bering Straits, they lost some, what, $30 million? Maybe you ought to just throw that one off to the side and have the land still intact and start another corporation you can make some money with. But you shouldn't encumber the land to pay off the debt of a corporate entity that's folding.
Well, we're also fighting strenuously over 7-9, right? That's the subsurface sharing mechanism. It's been in litigation for I don't know how long. We took a literate approach to NAMIC when we got our first, when we made an exploration agreement with Chevron. We had $2 million that we felt was shareable under a literal reading of 7-9, that if any revenues from the subsurface would be shared amongst all 12. So we passed out $2 million years ago, and it's still in the because of all the detailed arguments about what is deductible or not. We didn't go into that. We just passed money out. But nobody else took that approach. And on the farming bit, we do have, we are engaged in farming in NAMIC, primarily up along the Kobuk River and also Sello. Mark Marston set up a foundation. He was the head of the guard, organized Alaska Territorial Guard. And he set up a foundation to provide seed and farm implements, which we have taken advantage of for some years. And we got the legislature to provide several $100,000 last year. And we just voted, we just agreed to form a joint venture with Anoka Rural Ventures, which is a subsidiary of Control Data Corporation. Work with them in the development of farming.
Is that as a regional corporation project?
Well, it started out as a primarily the village of Selwyn, but it was tough to get all the parties together. You know, I mean, they had the Soil Conservation Service over here, and they had the village, and we had Manila. So we felt like we had to get into it to provide some direction to it and get the parties to work together. So that's what we're doing.
Your question was, why doesn't the individual have the land to do it himself?
Or pretty much, yeah. How come they haven't, convey some of the land for the individual to do it? Like there are wood contacts you can do by yourself individually, leave contacts coming forward.
I've heard a lot of argument. I'm enrolled to Cook Inlet region in Kenai, and we wanted to do that. We wanted to, there's some of us wanted to, maybe get 40, 50 acres apiece. Their argument is that there's no two pieces of land the same. There's no way to determine the value, so somebody's always going to be mad. Somebody got a better piece of land than the other person. Well, that's true, but that doesn't mean they couldn't do it if they wanted to. They could do it by lottery, or it'd be no different than the state. You saying that somebody got a better piece of land. That's why they do it by lottery. So it's a game of chance, and you take your chances on what you get. But no, it could be done. But it's not being done. Now under the IRA, it can't be done. It could be done, but they'd have to dissolve. Under the IRA, the tribe owns it all, and they can issue leases, or they can issue permits, or they can do anything they want. But they'll always own the land, and the land is tax free. And under the IRA. It's another thing you want to think seriously about. Under the IRA, they are a sovereign, so they can't be sued without their permission. And they got the protection of the federal government. So take an example. Let's say that Shyster come up and he worked out a deal and he got some property, and then he went broke and got in a fight with the council, and he tried to sue the tribal government. They'd throw it out of court, because he can't do that without the tribe's permission. Yes. The status of Venetai, first of all, recognize that they're very small villages, 150 people in Arctic and same in Venetai. Under the IRA, they have a better access to federal funding than those under the state do. The state has a tendency, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as a matter of fact, have a tendency to try to do everything politically on a per capita basis. So they might say, let's say that this village needs housing and this village needs industrial development. Well, they'll give $100 per capita for each. And that isn't enough to do either any good. Under the statutes, monies should be made available on the basis of need. So on that basis of need, we've helped the Venati, for example, get all new housing, all new water and sewer. Example, the state budgets maybe $200,000 or $300,000 per airport for the villages. We got $3 million for Arctic Village. Under the tribal government, they have the same authority to deal with the federal government for matching funds for public works as the state does. What the state does is they distribute it on a population basis. So you see, you know, half of the money going into Anchorage, you see another 20% going to Fairbanks, and by the time you whittle it down and try to spread the 10% to all the villages, there's not much left. I mean, there's not enough to really do something in the village.
Don, I've got a question. You're not a lot older than I am, but you know, you were born about 10 years after the First World War, right? I mean, putting it in that fashion makes it sound really ancient, but the point I was driving at was I would like for you to try to characterize the difference between some of your early recollections about how the Native people were or were treated, you know, in the interior, and how you see the changes that have taken place between then and now. I mean, you know, it's really, the things have changed a lot of ways, you know, and I suppose in not only the non-Native's perception of the Native, but also in the Native's perception of them,
right.
and their work in trying to work out this relationship.
I was born in 1929. My father, as an example, working with the church, got limited funding from the church to develop. As a matter of fact, the church, my father went to school in California, he went to school in Pennsylvania, he learned a little agriculture, a little carpentry, that kind of stuff, along with his church learning. So when he came back up, he established a sawmill, for an example, at Minto. Well, by the time I came along, old enough to recognize it, Minto was doing pretty well. He did establish a little agriculture there. They had plenty to eat. They had, they even, you know, had chickens and stuff like that. And they had timber and everything. And so he turned the sawmill over to the village people and let them start sawing for revenue while the church shut him down. That was one of his beefs with the church, because the church didn't want to see him succeed. Didn't want to see him successful, they get out from under the clutches of the church. The same thing has happened from a state standpoint. Anytime you see any enterprise start moving, BIA or somebody will deliberately, through vicious people, try to shut it down. They don't want to see that happen. World War II hit, you know, right in the early 40s, and that distorted everything, because everything was confiscated. No matter whether it was owned by Indians or white men or anybody, miners, the military came in and they confiscated everything, all the trucks, all the tractors, all the sawmills, everything. It was a military rule. And so they drafted all the able-bodied men, and they sent all the girls of age to schools out in Chihuahua, Chilocco, Lawrence, Kansas, wherever. So there was a terrible psychological, physical, real transition that they never recovered from. The girls that came back from school or couldn't stand it and came back, there were so many GIs in the country that they all either got married or became pregnant or started families. And so you had a terrible cultural, physical, human upheaval. nobody knew what to do. By the time it simmered down, we're already in the 50s. Here we got statehood, you know. Here the state's broke. So what does the state do immediately is they start trying to force first-class cities and boroughs and impose taxation. And so it's hard to say, how could you compare it? As far back as I can remember, they were doing well in an orderly transition, civilian-type transition, a little overpower on the church side and a little overpower on, like, the miners, the boomers. But there was a kind of a transition between the subsistence, quote, culture, hunting, fishing, trapping, berry gathering stuff, and phasing in a little agriculture because you couldn't ship anything in. There was no air transportation. So you had to till the ground. So it was moving very well, very orderly. And then World War II busted it all apart. And it never did come quite back together to this day. And this land claim settlement, as a matter of fact, that was one of our major arguments before the Congress, is the devastation of the infiltration of the military during World War II. And some of them understood it, but a lot of them didn't care. And that's where we are. We're in that transition between cultures at this point, and it's difficult. But I think that the tone of the leadership now is swinging. It, you know, the 10 years after, we're 10 years into the act now, that's halfway. 1991, everything becomes alienable to taxation, and everything becomes alienable to sale. They could sell anything they want, sell their stock. If that happened, there would be an extinct native culture. That again comes back to 7J. Those of us that believe that there should be preservation of culture, preservation of status, fought hard to keep 7J in, because here's what could happen. 1991 could come along, big companies, Japanese companies, I keep saying Japanese because they got so much investment up here in timber and fisheries and hotels.